15 hours, 0 minutes, Coordinated Universal Time. National Institute of Standards and Technology Time, this is radio station WWB, Fort Collins, Colorado, broadcasting on internationally allocated standard carrier frequencies of 2.5, 5, 10, 15, and 20 megahertz, providing time of day, standard time intervals, and other related information.
From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 167 of Little Brother, for the 11th of January, 2026. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com, or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, is a U.S. government agency primarily concerned with the maintenance of standards of measure. They had an issue recently. Among the things that they maintain is a set of atomic clocks, which are used to operate the primary U.S. time servers that your devices use to set their clocks. They are also used to broadcast the current time in excruciating accuracy over long-wave and short-wave radio, which are used by many self-setting clocks. The problem at NIST was that they suffered a power loss at their headquarters in Boulder, Colorado, leading to the time from the atomic clocks being unavailable. The clocks on the time server had only drifted about 4 microseconds before NIST decided to take them offline and leave them that way until they could restore normalcy. GPS, which draws its time from the U.S. Naval Observatory, was unimpacted. Immediately after deadline for my last episode, news came to me by way of electoralvote.com that TikTok has signed a deal to spin off its U.S. operations. That's it. If the political class wants to shut it down, they'll have to find new pretext. 45% of the operation will be owned by a consortium of investors, 33% by existing investors in ByteDance, which was TikTok's parent company in China, and 20% by ByteDance themselves. Not quite sure how that qualifies as spinning off, but there it is. There's a remaining portion that was not explained. The company will be operated by a 7-member board. Last month, right in time for Christmas, the Federal Communications Commission issued a ban on the importation of foreign-made drones. Now, when I first heard that, that was going to be the core of the story, but apparently there has been some pushback, and as of January 7th, the FCC has issued an addendum to the order, exempting some drones. The initial list would have restricted the import of all foreign-made drones. With the exemptions now in place, 8 vendors have been cleared to do imports. Also cleared are critical drone components from NVIDIA, Modal AI, Panasonic, Sony, Samsung, and Arc Electronics. Drones that had been approved prior to the ban were not impacted by it. An FAQ can be found on the FCC website. Finally, an old idea is new again. Groups like the Yes Men have a history of creating websites to parody those of corporate or government entities with names similar enough to get an occasional errant click. In that vein, comedian and screenwriter Toby Morton has registered the domain name TrumpKennedyCenter.org. Morton writes for South Park and Mad TV and had created a site that pokes fun at the administration's somewhat less than successful takeover of the Kennedy Center and the shift in the organization's values since that time. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned Now? It's not a new pwn, but one that bears follow-up. Back in December of 2023, orthopedic medical practice Ortho New York was pwned. Between then and now, a court case has played out over the matter, and the Albany Times Union is now reporting that they have been fined $500,000 by the state of New York for exposing the data of 650,000 patients. So, now we know the value of your privacy. $500,000 divided by 650,000 patients is about 77 cents apiece. Keep that in mind the next time you wonder if your privacy is valued, because this isn't even a deliberate exposure. Well, at least not on the legal side of things. On the illegal side of things, we have a ransom request that was sent to Condé Nast, the publisher of Wired magazine and others, who have similarly had their database pwned. The ransomware gang behind it are demanding $40 million. At that price, the nearly 286,000 subscribers' data would appear to be worth about $140 apiece. Oh, wait, maybe not. There was a lot of business data that was hoovered up in the breach as well. Maybe those customers are still only worth 77 cents. All right, we have a few AI-related stories in this episode. In the last episode, I talked a little bit about agentic AI. As a memory jogger, agentic just means that the AI has agency. That is, you can give it a task to do, and it can marshal resources and actually do things, as opposed to it just being able to tell you how to do it. In the state of Utah, some new programs are using agentic AI to help people get their prescriptions renewed. While my concerns about agentic AI remain, I have to say that it does actually look like these folks are doing this correctly. The company behind it, Doctronic, has tested this by having the AI perform diagnoses of telehealth patients and found that its diagnoses seem to align with those of human physicians. For a relatively small fee, the AI can call in renewed prescriptions to a pharmacy for you, or for a larger fee, you can see a human doctor about it. Ball is still in your court as the patient. Interestingly enough, I've never had to pay a fee for a simple renewal with my current doctor, but I don't know how things differ in this regard between New York and Utah, so that could easily be part of the difference, and it could also be something that is specific to the practice I use. I don't know. On the downside of AI and the downside of American culture, Gizmodo is reporting that librarians now have got a new problem, and it's probably nothing like what you would expect. It seems as though librarians are frequently on the receiving end of accusations that they are hiding knowledge. The source of this problem is AI hallucinations. From time to time, an AI will make up something entirely, and that something sounds completely plausible, but it's got no basis in reality. At the same time, though, it seems like some folks are turning to the AI and putting more trust in it than humans, which is not really a good idea. When you combine that trust with a sort of fundamental distrust of all maintainers of knowledge that seems to come from a conspiratorial mindset, you get this. And I don't see this getting any better. However, in other news, the humans are striking back as well. It seems as though the construction of AI data centers is somewhat controversial because of the localized negative impacts on the power grid, which really is just a fancy way of me saying that electric prices go up, and because of the noise of the machinery used to cool and to provide backup power. Whether you agree with it or not, the folks who have been standing in opposition to the building of data centers have given the owners of these places a reason to try to keep their installations on the down low. And this is where enters organizations like Epic AI, a nonprofit that uses traditional public records-based sleuthing, poring over satellite imagery, building permits, and the like, to map the growth of these data centers. And the result is an interactive map showing data center price tags, power consumptions, and who owns them. So I'm here this evening with Tim Fake. How would you describe yourself in terms of your expertise?
I'm a cybersecurity consultant and a visiting assistant professor at UAlbany in the cybersecurity department, which is in the College of Emergency Management, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity.
Tim has appeared recently a couple of times on our local CBS affiliate. That would be CBS 6 in Schenectady. I'm bringing him in tonight because we're going to talk a little bit about, ironically enough, deepfakes. So, Tim, tell me a little bit about what you have been trying to caution people about.
So there's been two interviews now on stuff that's similar in nature. The first interview was about the ability to clone voices using LLMs. And the second one was about teen usage and LLMs.
Now, some of my audience are going to know what LLMs are, and others are going to need a little bit of a primer. So can you back up a hair and tell us what LLM stands for and tell us a little bit about them?
So LLM stands for a large language model. I describe it as a fancy calculator, because that's really all it is. It's a linear algebra calculator. It's a word predictor. It takes in a large corpus of text, and it converts each word into a vector, and then it does some dot product on that vector. When it finishes its training, the next thing that happens is you enter some text in yourself as a user, and it will look at your text. It'll again tokenize that, and it will vectorize the whole thing. Each word will be a vector, and then it will look at the next most probable word or words or phrases that come from your text.
So in a nutshell, what you're describing here is simply looking at how the English language has been used in the information that the LLM has used to train on, mm-hmm. and trying to come up with what seems to make the most sense next.
Yes.
I think that it's important for my audience to understand, because I know that you all are from a wide variety of skill sets, a wide variety of backgrounds, and a wide variety of knowledge level, that when we talk about the sort of artificial intelligences that we have been talking about a lot lately, this is what's being described as a large language model. So a large language model can take words and it can put them into an order that seems to make a coherent conversation. What's the danger that we're running into in this particular case?
So in the case of the voice cloning, what a bad actor could do is they could take a snippet of your voice, stick it into a special version of a, we can genericize it, I guess we could call it a GPT type of model, another kind of similar to an LLM, except what it will do is it will break that voice pattern up into segments, phonemes, things like that, and it will actually take a kind of a heat map, I guess you could call it. And then it will take the heat map, and it will take the words that you want it to say, and it will take the heat map, modify itself it will synthesize your voice based on the clip, and it'll take the words that the bad actor wants it to say, and it will actually use your voice to say those words.
Sure. And to be clear, I've actually had this done to me, and I found it super creepy to hear my own voice reciting words that I know I didn't say.
Mm-hmm.
So how are these being used?
One of the things that bad actors are doing is they are calling up relatives and having a voice of a loved one say something to the effect of, "Mom, I'm in jail. I really need money. Send it to this account." That's one way they're using it. Another way that they're using it is to get access to bank accounts. So they will clone a person's voice. They will call up a bank, and they will put the person's voice on the phone and try to social engineer the person on the other end to give access to an account.
Interestingly enough, I used to be a member at a credit union that was small enough that that probably would have worked, because I was able to call them up and say, "Hello, this is Chuck Ritter," and that was all of the authentication that was necessary, because they had four employees and they all knew my voice.
Yep.
So that's a potential concern right there, is mm-hmm. any case where you've got a small enough group that they are likely familiar with you, there's a chance that they could fall for this particular trick.
Yes.
And it sounds to me like this is a variation on an older scam. It's just this is the high-tech version of it.
It is, yeah.
So I guess the thing that would probably be of the most interest to my audience is, what should people do about this?
So one method would be to make sure that you all have a safe word,
okay.
Which is kind of a bad name for it, but whatever. You have a safe word with your family members. That basically, if you call them up and you give them a phrase or whatever from your favorite movie, that is the indication that you are the person that you're claiming to be.
Okay.
And it's kind of similar to the bank process, right? They usually have you say certain things, give them certain pieces of information that nobody else would know
right.
when you call up.
Right.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
While I have you, we could also talk maybe about some of the other ways in which large language models have been problematic as of late. I understand you've done another interview with CBS6 in which you were talking about the way people were relating to them.
Yes. Teens, for some crazy reason, they use them all the time. A Pew Research poll recently said that I think 64% of, I think it's the number that they gave, of teens use them on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And some teens are actually using them as relationships, their best friends and their boyfriend or girlfriend.
Ouch.
And it seems rather bizarre, but that is what they're using them for, yes.
You know, I've seen anime series that were based on this very concept, so I guess in a way this is life imitating art, but
yeah.
I would have to think that it would not be a particularly fulfilling relationship.
I would think not. Obviously, there's no emotion there. You're essentially talking to a calculator and getting the calculator to spit back things you kind of want to hear, right? So if you're a lonely teen, don't have anybody, you can definitely see how there's an allure here.
Sure.
One of the most common problems with all LLMs is sycophancy. They will frequently tell you exactly what you want to hear. They'll make you the most important person in the room. And, you know, you can think of young, even middle teens really being caught on this. They really would love that center of attention type of feeling, which they probably don't get elsewhere. Another more recent thing that had happened, there had been two suicides. And it turned out that the LLMs kind of coaxed them into it. They didn't dissuade it.
Interesting.
Essentially, what they're supposed to do, what their guardrails are telling them to do, is if you have suicidal ideations, it's supposed to give you the suicide hotline phone number. And somehow this did not happen. Probably because, again, LLMs are very good at hallucinating, and it's very easy to get them out of their guardrails through these hallucinations.
Now, I've noticed that the thing that you have been repeating throughout here has been to think of the LLM as essentially a calculator, and I can totally understand how that would come about. I find that there's a certain irony in that this machine that is fundamentally a calculator is often actually very bad at actually carrying out math.
It is.
What's going on there?
It has to do with the way it's being trained, right? So that you have a huge corpus of text, and the text isn't always going to be accurate. You know, they don't have anybody sitting behind the scenes looking through the entire corpus that they're using to train the model and making sure that everything is actually accurate.
Would that even be a humanly possible feat?
No, it wouldn't.
Yeah.
Not unless you fed it only math books, for instance. Yeah, so it's definitely a challenge.
We've talked about some of the problems with LLMs. What do you see that they are particularly useful for?
I actually use them quite a bit.
Okay. Tell me about how you find them useful for your purposes.
So one of the things that I have done is created my own fitness plan. So the way that you use any tool is you want to make sure, especially a tool that's supposed to be providing you with information, is to make sure you verify your information before you actually use it. And you can actually have the LLM give you at least ChatGPT will do a web search for things, and it will spit up links. Make sure you follow those links and verify that the information that it's claiming is there is actually there. So when you come up with a fitness plan and it gives you some recommendations about running or about diet or whatever it happens to be, make sure you challenge it. You say, look, I want to know where this information is coming from. And then you go and verify that information is there. And if it's not there, you go back to the LLM and say, look, you are wrong here. Provide me with accurate information. And it will actually do that. And it'll do its typical sycophancy thing. And it'll say, oh, you're absolutely right. I'm so sorry about that. Let me find the actual piece of information. So that's one way I've used it. So next semester, I'm teaching all of my classes Oxford tutorial style. And the Oxford tutorial style, just for those of you who don't know, I'm going to get a group of five students in a room. They are all going to have a problem statement at the beginning of the week that they are going to have to do research on. And they're going to have to write a 3-to-5-page paper on it. They're going to have to come in, and I'm going to grill them on that. I'm going to ask them questions. And they are going to have to answer on the fly. So this is to make sure that they know their material, they know their arguments, they can articulate well, and they actually know the material that they are doing research on. So the way I use the LLMs for this is I asked an LLM, all right, so my class is wireless security, and this is what I want to do in the class. This is the information I want to cover, and this is the overall story arc. I want the students to be wireless security analysts, and I want them to be working with a particular company. I want you to come up with some problem statements for me for each week to actually drive home this arc and use real-life signals to be able to analyze for these students. And it did that for me. I had an entire semester done pretty quickly, probably within 2 days. I went through every single one and verified that it was accurate information, had it suggested signals for them to analyze. I made sure that they were all available out there on the web somewhere, and I actually did the process myself just to verify everything. So that's definitely another way I've used it. So the research that I'm working on, I'm interested in being able to model an attacker's thought process as they do an attack. And so I've been using an LLM to basically work as a kind of a research assistant.
Okay.
And an adversary with me. So I would tell it, all right, I want you to push back on me as much as possible with what you know, and I want you to be able to provide me with resources on where this is going, where you're getting the information from. And so it's kind of like a sparring partner. So that's another thing that I found really useful.
I love it. Tim, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Tim Fake is a security consultant and visiting professor of cybersecurity at the University of Albany. We spoke about AI on January 2nd. There's a lesson in politics that never seems to get learned. Since there are only two really viable political parties in the country, they will take turns doing things that empower them without realizing that someday, even if you don't expect it, the tables can turn and the other party will be in power, and the structures they put in place now will benefit the opposition then. The classic case where they actually do understand this is the filibuster. Both parties seem to understand that this is beneficial to the party not in power, and as such, it stays in place. On the flip, though, it has recently come to light that Representative Dan Goldman, a Democrat from New York, took a stance against privacy back during the Biden administration by backing a law that would enable the government to spy on the telecoms traffic of Americans with no warrant requirement by way of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. While the law does not enable direct surveillance of Americans, the incidental collection of data on Americans is apparently somehow permissible. Well, now that the Republicans are in control of the White House, the Supreme Court, and both houses of Congress, and an authoritarian vision of the right is taking shape in reality, Goldman's primary opponents are whacking him hard for this decision. Now, you all already know my politics. Some of you know me personally and are well aware that what I have just said was profoundly tame in the context of what I actually think here. If that's where your mind is, I want to ask you to stop for a second, bring it back to a nonpartisan view of the situation, where we have both major political parties desiring to strip the American populace of its privacy. I won't get into how it varies by degree from one party or the other. It's irrelevant. Instead, I want you to take note of the fact that both parties want you not to have privacy. And even if you trust the party in power now, they will eventually have to hand over the reins of power to the other party. And whatever they set up when they are in power, they must hand over with those reins. Do you see where I'm going with this? So, as we start into the election season, here's what I want you to do. First, if you are registered to a party, make sure you vote in the fucking primaries. Take a moment in the process to determine where the candidates in the party stand on privacy and vote for the candidate who is most likely to help you retain as much of your privacy as humanly possible. Second, if you are not registered to a party, consider fixing that. The traditionally rational thing to do here is to register for the party that most represents your views. However, depending on what the field of candidates looks like, you could also register instead for the other party, and as an act of sabotage, which there's actually a lovely term for this, they call it rat fucking. Either way, it is important to make your voice heard in this fight. You're not going to get any traction in the general. You've got to get it in the primaries. There's an election coming up, and if you shut up now, I don't want to hear about it later. Following up that commentary, we have a few privacy-related news items. We start in the UK, where the regulation of an industry has driven its clients underground. Back in July of last year, the UK enacted new measures requiring that adult websites, yes, pornography, get a positive ID on the viewer for purposes of age verification. Last month, there was reportage in The Independent, a UK-based newspaper, that traffic to porn sites, appearing to come from the UK, has fallen off sharply, but that the number of Britons using VPNs has about doubled. Of course, We don't really know where that VPN traffic is going, which is precisely the point. But I would think we could probably take a pretty good guess. Now this month, The Independent has added to the narrative by reporting that the usage of what they are calling unregulated porn sites is on the rise. This information is based on a survey of British internet users, and it has raised concerns that when wandering into the territory of porn sites that are operated outside of and untouched by the UK legal constraints, there comes a risk of child porn being made available. It is worth noting that several states in the US have enacted similar laws and will likely have the same outcome. The objections to positively identifying yourself for purposes of viewing pornography should be pretty obvious, really, and this outcome is entirely predictable. In other news, privacy-first messaging app Signal has seen a recent boost in downloads in Greenland and Denmark. The Google Play Store currently lists it as the number one app in the communication category. It was number 9 last month. This outcome also is no surprise and likely stems from the rising tensions over increasingly bellicose stated intentions by the U.S. executive branch to take possession of Greenland from Denmark by any means necessary. As usual, we'll end the show with the fail of the fortnight. There's been a lot of news about the Epstein files, but one thing that seems to have slid under many people's radar is Exhibit 1 from the 2022 court case of U.S. versus Virgin Islands. This document, as all of them, has a number of redactions. At least some of them rightfully so. I have not looked at the document myself, but my understanding is that victims' names are the primary concern. It seems, though, that in a mistake that should have been understood as much as 20 fucking years ago, there is a right way to do this and a wrong way. The right way is to take the image of the text, block it out in black, supply the reason, and then ensure that the metadata does not contain the text. The wrong way to do it is to skip that last step, or worst, simply overlay a shape over the offending text. In the case of the exhibit I mentioned a minute ago, they did it the wrong way. Getting the original, unredacted text is as simple as selecting it all and copying it. You can then paste it into a text editor or a word processor and read it. And we knew this 20 fucking years ago. In another example of government failure, Representative Anna Paulina Luna is threatening journalist Seth Harp, calling for a DOJ investigation into him. What, pray tell, is Harp's crime? Well, Harp went to the Duke University website. There, he found a biography of someone who was involved in the kidnapping of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and posted that biography, which was publicly available already, posted that biography on X. That's it. Copy from one place, paste to another place. copy from one public place, paste to another public place. The subject of the biography is a U.S. Army colonel and a Delta Force commander. He is not being named at this point, presumably out of some fear of reprisal from the administration. Well, so much for the First Amendment. It's had a great run, but I guess it does not cover Control-C or Control-V. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fungaboo and the Helix Foundation for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Azriel, Frog's Butts, Julie Bernstein, Fungaboo, Thriller at Play, and Alex Matthews for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Punt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Privacy News music is Capricorn Mix by Leander. Our Fail of the Fortnite music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker, and our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or concerns about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next time when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Episode 168 will drop on the 25th of January. Stay safe and be well.